A good Monday morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's been called the most overlooked of the five senses, but it has the power to transport us back to our past with surprising power. It can induce euphoria and joy. It can even help us pick the right partner for having children. Without it, we tend to spiral into increasing depression, feeling disconnected from ourselves and the world. This hour, we'll dive nose first into the world of smell. Tell us what your sense of smell means to you. Have you ever been overcome by a powerful memory that was triggered by scent? And what are your favorite and least favorite smells? I hope you'll join in this hour and call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this hour is Rachel Hertz. She's recognized as the world's leading expert on the psychology of smell. She studies the scents at Brown University and is the author of The Scent of Desire. Rachel Hertz, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Veronica. Great to be here.
You start your book with a great story about the time when you were a child and you discovered a very interesting smell appealed to you. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. The very interesting smell is the smell of skunk. And what was happening at the time is that I was in the car. I was about 5 years old, sitting in the back seat, the windows open, and it was in the summertime. We were driving through the countryside, beautiful day, and all of a sudden there was this smell there. And at the very same moment, my mom said, "Oh, I love that smell." And I loved it too. And it wasn't until several years later that I discovered I was in a minority of people who would at least openly admit that they liked that smell. But the reason why that's such a good anecdote for this book is because it really speaks to the idea that our responses to smells are learned, and they're learned through the emotional association we make to them. And so because my emotional association was very positive in that moment, I like that smell. Had I had learned through the normal cultural channels that skunk smell is bad, I may have thought otherwise because I would have had a different connotation for it. But before ever having that connotation, I had learned that I liked it.
I think you describe it somewhere as a cross between chocolate and garlic.
Yes. If I were to give some verbal descriptors to it, that's probably what I would say. Some other people might say other things, but that's my sort of dissection.
Do you still like the smell of skunk?
I most definitely do.
Well, it's a funny story, but like you said, it illustrates the point also that no two people really share the same set of likes and dislikes when it comes to smell, right?
Right. I mean, you can find a lot of cultural overlap, and that's certainly something that most people in the industry that make fragrances are hoping for, that there's going to be sort of a consistency, culturally speaking, of what fragrances are liked in what kinds of products, what fragrances are liked in general, and certainly in the food industry, this is a major deal. But food flavor, which is really all about smell, because our sense of taste is only salt, sour, sweet, bitter, and a fifth one called umami. Everything else we get from our experience of food comes from our nose. So the smell of steak is, or the, rather the taste of steak is just salt. And what we experience when we chew on a delicious piece of steak is the scent of steak. So culturally speaking, we know one man's meat is another man's poison. So there's a really large diversity when it comes to culture. And then individuals within the culture can have their own idiosyncratic experiences, like myself.
Well, it was interesting to read that Britons do not like the smell of wintergreen or root beer, which are appealing to Americans.
Exactly. And you would think, well, why is that? And, you know, especially two countries that are relatively close in culture. And it's because in both those cases, those scents are fragrances that appear in medicine. So they do not have any connotation with sweets or drinks or relaxation or a treat or anything of that nature. And in particular, the wintergreen one has a history of having been used in an analgesic rub that was very commonly available during World War II, which not only is it medicine, but it's wartime. So it has a very negative stigma associated to it as a scent. And yet, for North Americans, it's candy.
Yeah, that's true. And tell us, there are further ones that go beyond the British and Americans. For example, jackfruit, which is an Asian fruit, mm-hmm. is said to smell like a corpse, pretty much, right?
Yes. And to be honest, I've in fact never smelled it myself, but I've heard many stories of its experience told to me, and I've had them told to me by people who love it and people who despise it. And it's one of those fascinating things where it's kind of an experience of sort of the local delicacy, where the people who know it as a fruit that is, you know, highly regarded think that it's the best thing, and people who don't think of it like that can't even imagine going anywhere near it with their mouth. Another example is natto or cheese, those comparison between the two. Natto is a fermented soybean dish that the Japanese regularly have for breakfast, and I have smelled that. I have attempted to eat it and been relatively unable to. I think I've managed to take a tiny bite because it doesn't have any scent to it that is in any way connected in my mind with food. It, to me, smells like burning rubber, plasticky kind of smell. And, you know, liking or disliking the smell of burning rubber is another story, but no food that I know of smells like that. So it's not only just liking or disliking the smell, but the meaning of the smell is just completely disconnected. And Asians think that cheese is the next thing to vomit. So it's, again, a cultural association.
Well, and it's interesting also to note that the military, the U.S. military, has tried to develop a kind of stink bomb that would disperse a crowd more safely than tear gas, and they couldn't do it across cultures.
Exactly, and that's another perfect example where one of the odors was called U.S. Army latrine issue scent, and that particular smell, amongst the others that were, you know, rated as being highly aversive, at least amongst the individuals who developed them, was unable to be able to be used consistently across cultures. And if you think about it, you know, there's many cultures where sewage is not treated the way it is in North America, and open sewers and so forth are prevalent. So that smell could be as sort of everyday as the smell of gas that we encounter walking down, you know, a city street here. So not to say that it's necessarily a smell that people are running to get near, but certainly not to the degree that it would be negative enough to get anyone to leave the area.
Well, you've spent your academic career, certainly studying the sense of smell, and you've really become a champion of it and called it one of the most overlooked of the five senses, but one that shouldn't be overlooked. Can you take a moment and talk about why this particular sense is so fascinating to you and maybe why we should appreciate it?
Well, I think the reason why the sense of smell is so fascinating to me personally is because it's such an amazing it has such an amazing link to emotion and also to emotional memory, and those two topics are things that I'm deeply interested in. And our sense of smell is really sort of a sensory equivalent to our experience of emotion, and I'm totally fascinated by this concept. What I mean by that is that what smell tells animals, ourselves included, in a very basic way, is information related to approach and avoid. And you have to think of the fact that all of our senses are there for a purpose, to give us information about the world. And so smell tells you, go towards it because it's good, or get away from it because it's bad. And this is fundamentally what emotions are actually telling us to do as well. Positive emotions tell us to go forward, to approach the object and so forth, and negative emotions tell us to get away from it or fight to protect ourselves. And from this basic survival aspect, you know, going towards something in the positive sense because it's helpful for your survival, getting away from something because it's dangerous for your survival, this has this direct analogy. And I believe that, you know, human experience of emotion, which presumably is the most evolved of any other creature on the planet, is in a way an extrapolation of the information that our sense of smell gives us. And we also use our sense of smell much less than most other creatures on the planet do. So it's kind of like a trade-off in our emotional development from our smell development. And from a neuroevolutionary perspective, too, the part of the brain that controls emotion, the part of the brain that controls smell processing, they're directly interconnected. And in fact, the part of the brain that controls emotion grew out of the tissue that was processing smell. So there's this really deep connection, which is very interesting to me.
You have a beautiful quote from Nabokov in your book, and he said, "Smells are surer than sights or sounds to make your heartstrings crack." Can you tell us what he means by that and why smell is so closely tied up with memory?
Well, that particular quote, again, it refers to emotion, and that's sort of the basic connection between smell and emotion, how immediately upon smelling something, you don't even have to think about it. It immediately goes to a piece inside you that is good or bad, and it's often a long time, relatively speaking, that later before you figure out why you feel that way. And in terms of it being attached to memory, that's certainly the case. You know, you have a smell that may trigger a memory for you, and what seems to be happening in terms of the unfolding of that memory is that the first experience is this feeling, and you don't know exactly why you're having this feeling, and then the event comes back to you. And that's very different from when we hear something and when we see something. When we hear or see something, it's the event first, and then we appraise it. That was this time when I had a, you know, it was a great evening out and so forth. I was with my best friends, or a negative version of that. But the appraisal emotionally comes after the sort of concrete cognitive event, whereas in smell, it's the opposite. You know, emotion is primary.
And I'm wondering about the story in your book, a wonderful story. I think it was a relative of yours who was helping some friends wash dishes.
Right.
And she was overcome.
Exactly. So this is this example of how emotions come first. So this was my cousin Amanda, who's doing dishes at her friend's house, and suddenly finds herself weeping over the sudsy sink and can't figure out what's going on, nor can her friend, wondering what's happening here, and eventually realizes that the smell of the dish soap that she was using at this friend's house was the same dish soap that our grandmother had used, that she had not smelled since the last time she had been with her, and our grandmother was deceased now, and so there was this kind of sudden memory of our grandmother, who she was very close to, and it came back without words first, that feeling of sadness and nostalgia and closeness, and then it was, oh my gosh, it's my grandmother, and this is why I'm feeling like this, and I miss her so much. So it's an example of how the emotion just really drives our memory experiences with smell.
That's a case where your cousin actually figured out what was going on. Does it happen fairly often where we do get a strong emotional reaction, but we maybe never put our finger on the fact that it's because of smell?
That could happen. I think that it depends, again, you know, sort of on the person and how much time they have to reflect on it in any given moment. So certainly we can have emotional responses to things and not be totally aware of why we've gotten them, and that they may be due to smell is certainly possible.
And there's another story in your book about what happens when we don't have the sense of smell, when we lose that sense, and it's more devastating than you'd think.
Absolutely, and actually one of the main reasons why I wrote this book is because of the fact that I got to be an expert witness for a woman who lost her sense of smell in a car accident, and she was, you know, in her late 20s, just sort of a very typical person, job, newly married, etc., and had never paid very much attention to her sense of smell at all. And suddenly, here there was this devastating change in her life after the car accident. Actually, she had extremely severe facial injuries and had numerous cosmetic surgeries. So this was a very traumatic accident. And when I met her, it was about a year later. And she'd recovered physically from it completely at this point, but had now become aware of the fact that she had lost her sense of smell in this accident, and that not only was she missing the sense, but that everything about her life had changed for the negative. She felt she was very self-conscious in front of other people because she was always worried that she might have bad body odor. She felt that she was disconnected socially because she didn't have a sort of a sense of herself or sense of her own past through her memory. She had become less interested in being intimate with her husband because she couldn't smell him, and she said that prior to that his smell had been very important for her. She decided she wasn't going to have children, to her great distress, because she was worried she would be a bad mother because she wouldn't be able to smell if something was burning or if food was spoiled and so forth. And she was becoming increasingly more depressed and withdrawn.
So that's sort of an illustrative point about how we might take smell for granted in many cases. But in fact, it turns out that maybe being blind, which I would imagine most people would say they'd rather lose their sense of smell than their sight, but actually being blind, people are discovering, is not as devastating as losing the sense of smell.
Well, right. I mean, what happens is when someone becomes blinded compared to someone loses their sense of smell, initially the person who's become blind is going to be feeling much worse than the person who's lost their sense of smell. But when you follow these people, you know, a year or so later, and you find out how they've adapted to their current life, the people who are blind evaluate themselves as just as happy as they were before they ever had the accident which caused their blindness. So they've readjusted. But the people who've lost their sense of smell have, through that period of time, sort of gone in a downward spiral. And often, it's not always the case, but depending on one's personality and maybe one's connection to certain types of things that smell was really a part of, it becomes worse and worse. And because there's this emotional connection that's really a neurological connection, when you're not getting sort of input into the sense of smell from the outside, I believe that there is actually a consequence to emotional processing on the inside because of the fact these two systems are so interrelated, neurologically speaking.
We're talking this hour with Rachel Hertz. She is recognized as one of the world's leading experts on the psychology of smell. She's the author of The Scent of Desire. Hope you'll join in our conversation this hour. Talk about smells that have been important to you, smells that you like and can't account for, and maybe smells that you don't like. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic by Joseph J. Ellis. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you this hour for Kathleen Dunn here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking smell this hour with Rachel Hertz, who is the author of The Scent of Desire. And Rachel Hertz, I noticed after I read your book last night as I was preparing for this hour that I started to smell everything. I hadn't been aware of any smells until then, and suddenly I could smell the soap really acutely in the bathroom, sort of the mustiness of the comforter that needed some airing out. Is it possible to sort of train yourself to be a sort of deeper smeller?
Well, absolutely, and that's a great example, Veronica, of how much attention is in fact important for our sense of smell. So literally just paying attention to smell can make you more sensitive to smell, literally being able to more acutely smell things that were there all along. So it's not as though your nose suddenly got a super boost, but rather that because of your attention, it literally became super boosted. And so one of the things that I think I was hoping that this book would enable people to do is that they would realize that their sense of smell is so involved in their lives, and they would start paying attention to it, literally stopping to smell the roses, and thereby enrich their experiences that much more by sort of feeling everything that smell can give you.
Well, it did seem sort of a richer world than the one I'd been in before I read your book. It seemed a bit fleshed out.
I like to think of that, and I like to think that sort of in a sort of a crude analogy, smell is like the color on a television set that would otherwise be black and white.
Well, I want to go to the phones right now, and we have Mark and Lafarge waiting to talk to you. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that at least these concerns were articulated during your show. We all love a truly spring fresh smell when the windows open and the laundry's hanging out. Excuse me. But the springtime fresh smell that's built into soaps are made with synthetic chemicals, a number of which are carcinogenic. There is no regulatory body, as I understand it, that's reviewing these fragrances. And they become endemic in our society. You can't go to a public washroom today without an aerosol container on a timer spraying out mist that you're breathing in and it's getting onto your clothes. There are some people in our society that might have breathing disorders that are severely impacted by some of these airborne particulates, these canisters that you plug in that have oil in them. You plug them into your socket, and they basically create airborne droplets of oil that contain just a myriad of synthetic compounds. I'd refer listeners that are concerned about this and this untested bath that we're taking every day in artificial fragrances to consult the website for HEAL. That's the Human Ecology Action League. They're the point. It's a nonprofit, and they've done some excellent work on exposing these concerns. So when the little vignette that your guest presented about the woman whose dish soap odor affected her psychology at that moment in time, I would suggest that it's also there's a physiological response, and unfortunately, these responses are mostly deleterious to our health.
What do you think about the chemical world of smell, Rachel Hertz?
Well, actually, this is sort of something which gets in people's minds a lot, the idea that there's a difference between natural and synthetic odors, and all odors are chemicals, and in fact, natural so to speak, odors have much, much more chemical complexity to them and also typically cause more allergic reactions than synthetic versions of that. So, for example, the aroma of rose from your flower bed contains something like 1,200 different chemical molecules, and the synthetic version of that is only one. And there are numbers of, there's actually one company that's developing synthetic versions of a variety of scents because the natural one produces allergic reactions. And with respect to the regulatory issue and fragrances, what there is not is a body which, when a product is in its final form, evaluates the perfume fragrance of it. However, all companies that make chemicals that go into products that are available for human consumption have to actually go through quite a lot of rigorous external validation for the particular chemicals themselves and the safety of them for them to get anywhere near human product usage. So there really is not any evidence that supports the idea that there is a danger from the point of view of carcinogens and so forth from inhaling synthetic chemicals. That being said, there are individuals who have allergic propensities, and they can be triggered by particular chemicals. So whether they encounter that in a synthetic form or natural form is the particular individual, but without that particular sensitivity or without that, you know, idiopathic connection, there really is not a effect of smells in that particularly negative way. And also, there is not a pharmacological impact from smells. We don't smell something and it produces the effect like a drug would produce. Any physiological changes that take place as a function of smelling something come about as sort of the second order sequela of an emotional reaction. It's like if you start to think about something that annoys you, your heart rate will start to increase. Now, your heart rate is increasing. That's a physiological reaction, but it occurred through a psychological mechanism, and smells work in that same way.
Thank you for the call, Mark. And we go to Tom in Door County now. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Years ago, when I first got into the dentist's office, when they were first starting with nitrous oxide, they had flavors, and there was an orange flavor. And the first time I went through that, I became upset to the stomach a little bit, not really sick. But ever since then, that's probably 25, 30 years ago, anytime I'm in a confined space and somebody cracks open an orange, I have to fight against that same kind of impulse and nausea. So, you know, you were talking about instant memory. That is an instant that it happens.
Well, that's an excellent point, and that's an exact, actually, illustration of what I was saying before about the physiological reaction that can take place from a learned emotional association. And what sometimes happens with people who have chemical allergies to various aromas is that they become very distressed physically in the presence of an aroma because of the past connection to it, and it feels completely physical. Like, I'm sure you're feeling nauseated, feels totally physical, but it's triggered through this association with the smell, and that's an excellent illustration of that.
How good are we at smelling, Rachel Hertz? You think of something, an animal like a dog, and they seem to really have a deeper sense of smell than we do. Do you have any sense of where humans fall on the spectrum of smelling?
Traditionally speaking, humans are put at the end of the spectrum in terms of being particularly poor smellers, but there have been a number of researchers recently who have been contesting this, so that they were not so terrible after all. And it is the case that most likely our sensitivity to smell is poorer than most other animals, particularly as a function of the fact that we use our sense of smell less so for survival-based reasons than other animals who do really rely on their sense of smell for that. But that most likely our capability for detection of particular chemicals that have smells are comparable. So the difference between us and a dog is not that the dog is able to smell things that we literally could never smell, but that the animal is so much more sensitive to the particular chemicals that they can detect it at very low, low levels compared to where we would need much, much, much more. So where a bloodhound could potentially detect the scent of a drop of chocolate in a big city street, a human would need to have the chocolate right in front of their nose to be able to smell it. So it's not a question of the particular smells that the animal can experience that we can't experience, but the degree of sensitivity to that smell.
As a smell researcher, do you ever look at that bloodhound and feel a little bit of envy?
Well, I look at my dog all the time whenever I walk her, and she snuffles around the grass all over the place, and I'm thinking, what are you experiencing? And I'd love to sort of know what that feels like. But just to go on the intensity angle a little bit further to explain it a bit more physiologically, the differences that have been found between us and other animals also is in the number of receptors that we actually express for detecting smells. And we are expressing fewer than most other animals are, particularly animals that use their sense of smell a lot. And what this seems to suggest is that the more receptors you have, the more sensitive you'll be. And that's why there is this difference. And there's also some differences between people who, you know, ostensibly would have a normal sense of smell, both of them, where one person may have more receptors expressed than somebody else and therefore be more sensitive to certain chemicals. And one of the explanations I offer from my experience with skunks is that and maybe this is genetic too, and my mother as well, could be missing some receptors that might otherwise be very sensitive to some of the chemicals in skunk spray, whereas someone who looks at me like I'm insane to ever possibly like the smell of skunk may have more receptors that are capable of detecting some of those odors. So we all vary slightly when it comes to our hardware for smell, and that can make our smell worlds slightly different.
Going back to the phones now, let's take a call from George in Oshkosh. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Thank you. When my mother died, I went to her closet, and I start smelling all her clothes to see which one smelled more like my mother. And I put it in 3 bags. And usually, every now and then, I open the bags, and I smell. And although the smell is not the same, I try to figure out a little bit of the original smell. And my question is, why there's not a way to record smells? I mean, I wish I had a photo. I mean, something like that. Why nobody thought about recording the smell of your father or mother?
Well, that's a beautiful idea. And what you're talking about is something that's been called comfort smelling, where people really do what you just said. And one of the problems with it is, in a way, the more you try to smell it, the more the smell seems to disappear. And one of the things that's happening in that case is that your receptors are adapting to that smell. So it's like the harder you try, the less it's there. And especially if you're sniffing, you know, in a strong way, that makes it even faster for the receptors to adapt. So it feels like it's fading even further. But having the ability to record smells, that's actually, you know, a great idea. And some companies currently are trying to do just that in various technologies, having ways that certain smells could be recorded and then reproduced later. The problem, however, is from a chemical perspective, there are many, many chemicals which produce smells that we have no idea what the outcome is going to be. So there's actually very poor prediction from chemical to actual outcome. And with something as complex as human body odor, which, by the way, is unique to each one of us, to be able to recreate that specifically from a chemical perspective, so you'd have to have a system which had, you know, an array of chemicals in it, and it would emit a certain pattern, and that would be your mother. But given the possibilities between individuals being so huge, it's sort of an impracticality. But there are potential ways that, you know, in a more simple sense, like smells of rose or lilac and more common smells, that could be reproduced and re-sent back to us. But that's a beautiful idea in any case.
So you don't think this is something that could happen 50 years down the road?
Well, the problem, it can certainly happen, like I said, with the more common smells that we know what causes that smell from a chemical perspective. But without... And I suppose, actually, if I think about it now, this is very good. Since we could take an imprint of someone while they were alive in terms of their body odor and do chemical analysis on that odor imprint of them, figure out what those chemicals were that were expressed in their body odor, and then recreate that. So that actually could be possible, but I think that the feasibility of that, since it would be sort of so individualistic, I think there's sort of an economic practicality to it. But that would be how you would do it, I think, if you wanted to.
Thank you for that call, George. And we take one now from Tom in Minocqua. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I had two things to say. One is that I like the smell of the skunk, too, because it's associated with a boyhood camping trip that I really enjoyed. So ever since then, if I get that sense of skunk smell, it's great. And the second thing is, I'm wondering if I'm a psychotherapist, and the idea that, you know, I tell my clients, make sure you show affection to each other in a relationship every day. Maybe I should make sure they get close enough to smell. Maybe that's connected with it. I just wondered what your comments were.
Well, it's absolutely connected with it, and I don't know if you've had, if you do any marital counseling and have ever encountered someone saying, particularly a woman, that she is now finding the smell of her husband really offensive. And it seems very likely that the way that a person actually smells, and this is both has an effect with respect to your unique biology and your personal body odor, as well as the fragrances that you use, has a very big impact, particularly for women, in terms of their attraction for men. And one of the things that I think is important in a relationship context, depending upon where the relationship is at that time, that if it's a positive one, that you certainly build on using smell as part of that in terms of increasing the intimacy and closeness, but that if a relationship has gone awry, and again, this would be more, I suppose, in a marital sense, and you're trying to help the couple get back on their feet, and the woman has found that her husband's smell is a real impediment to getting close to him, then he'd want to sort of change that smell completely and sort of reinvent himself to start anew from that perspective. But smell plays a very big role in women's attraction to men.
And maybe you say unsurprisingly, but men choose physical beauty over the smell of a woman.
Yes. Men are sort of, and the reason for our interest in smell versus looks has a biological basis in terms of the sort of the evolutionary rewards and costs of reproduction. So for women, because of the fact that so much goes into the sort of reproduction of a child from the point of view of energy and time and so forth. And since the biological ideal is to have many replicas of yourself genetically that are healthy and go forth and multiply themselves, women need to be most concerned about the fact that they're going to have a healthy child or not. And because our unique body odor is actually the outward manifestation of our immune system, which is unique to each one of us unless we have an identical twin, this is a very important signal for not only the health of that individual, but also the potential compatibility between the two individuals and how healthy the child will be that results from it. And there have been several studies that have shown that women choose on the basis of smell men whose genetics are complementary to their own in terms of their immune system. That is to say, that is sort of a best combination. And so that actually is a very important feature when it comes to smell and attraction, whereas for men, given the looks issue, it's because of the fact that prior to genetic testing, men only have a probabilistic sense of knowing that this particular child is mine. And so the idea is that what we think of in terms of good looks are actually signals of fertility. So youthfulness, hip-to-waist ratio of a certain type, lustrous hair, full lips, and so forth, all those features in women are actually signals also of fertility. So men are looking for probably the best chance, as it were, if you can't be 100% certain, and women are looking for the best health.
We're talking this hour with Rachel Hertz, who has been recognized as the world's leading expert on the psychology of smell. She studies the scents at Brown University and is the author of the book, The Scent of Desire. Hope you'll join in the conversation this hour as we revel in the sense of smell. Tell us what smell memories you have, or maybe what smells you like and don't like, and why. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1234. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11 today, Larry Mueller's guest focuses on personal computing problems. He's Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison, personal computer consultant. That's Larry Mueller after 11 o'clock today. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking smell this hour, the psychology and science of it, along with the memories, sharing those today as well. You can join in our conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. And Rachel Hertz, let's go back to the phones, and here's a call from Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. The odor of tobacco smoke is incredibly obnoxious and offensive to non-smokers. that tobacco smoke and nicotine deaden the sense of smell of smokers, or do they actually enjoy the smell of tobacco smoke? Does tobacco smoke smell good to smokers?
Were you going to say something, Monica?
No, okay. Go ahead.
Well, that's a very good point, because what actually you're bringing up is the fact that one of the really unique things about our sense of smell is that the receptors that pick up chemicals that go directly into the brain are in fact sitting right out there without any protective barrier. So in all of our other senses, we have a protection between the receptors that go to the brain and the outside world. With smell, they're really sitting at the back of your nostrils, so if you could stick your finger up high enough, you could touch them. And the problem with that is that because they're out there exposed to the environment, they do get damaged and killed off as a function of environmental toxins like smoke. And so what happens to smokers is that as a function of smoking, their olfactory receptors become more damaged. Now, one of the interesting things about our sense of smell as well is that our olfactory receptors regenerate themselves every 28 days or so, which means that if you quit smoking, you will then, after about a month, have a normally functioning sense of smell. But two smokers, while they're smoking, yes, they are both less sensitive to smoke in the first place because of the loss of certain receptors, as well as the fact that we adapt to smells that we're constantly exposed to. So even when it used to be the case that you'd walk into a bar or restaurant and it would be filled with smoke, you might walk in at first and go, oh, geez, this is awful. But after about 20 minutes or so, it's bothering you much less, and that's because you've physically adapted to it. And smokers would have the same thing. And in fact, I've heard that from ex-smokers, the smell of cigarette tobacco is particularly negative to them. Not so much, some people who are not smokers actually like the smell of cigarette smoke because of its associations to things. Actually, myself, I'm a non-smoker, but my father was a smoker. And when I smell cigarette smoke sometimes, I get a very sort of soft, sad, nostalgic memory of him that's quite positive in a lot of ways. And so there's an example of having a positive connection, again, just on association. But smokers do have a different sense of smell while they're smoking.
I've heard that the aroma from pipes is often considered a comforting smell for people who grew up with it.
Exactly. So grandpa and the pipe tobacco and that sort of, particularly because it's much less common now, so it becomes connected to a particular event in someone's past as opposed to being something that's so ubiquitous. I mean, one of the things with odors which are able to produce personal memories for people is they tend to need to be smells that aren't encountered all the time. So the smell of coffee, for example, is unlikely to be a strong personal memory evoker for many people because we smell coffee so often. But smells which are more rare, and those also which tend to be encountered in only certain types of situations, are going to be more likely to be ones which evoke strong personal memories. And pipe tobacco is certainly more rare than cigarette tobacco.
Well, thank you for that call, Daniel. And let's take one now from Connie in Arcadia. Hi, Connie, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two things. My husband had a concussion as a teenager and totally lost his sense of smell and just brushes it off. It bothers him not at all. In fact, I think it keeps him from overeating. but the thing that interested me recently, and I can't remember what, I'm always picking up a book and reading a little bit, but some person thought, you know, I wonder if I could smell like a dog. And he, for an experiment, he had somebody he knew go to a bookcase and pick up a book without him looking at it, you know, without him knowing what it was. And then he smelled that person's hand, and then he went to the bookcase and tried to determine what book had been handled, and he was successful. He couldn't say that he smelled it, but he had this notion that he did. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting, and I wondered, you know, I think that would be a fun thing to try, except that I think as you age, I really doubt that as a 68-year-old it would work.
Thank you for that call, Connie. Rachel Hertz, is there evidence that our sense of smell becomes less acute as we age?
Absolutely. And so what's happening, as I mentioned before, is that our olfactory receptors are regenerating themselves every 28 days or so. And this is what a normal, healthy person is experiencing up till probably about the age of 45, maybe somewhat older. But what happens after 45, and it seems to get worse, particularly after 65, and then particularly bad after 80, is that the ability to regenerate these receptors becomes weaker. So just like with eyesight and with hearing, and our experiences of smell also become weaker as we age. And 65 is usually one of the cutoff points where this becomes more obvious. And it's exactly because the sort of ratio of cell reproduction, new cells replacing the ones that have died off, isn't in balance anymore, so more depleted than are actually being regenerated. And unfortunately, we do not have currently sort of hearing aids for the nose, but I do think that technology is possible in the future. That there could be things, and it would not be something like a device. I don't think that would be clamped into the nose or anything, but I think that there are compounds that could be used that could boost the gain on whatever olfactory receptors were left so that you could be smelling the equivalent that you could have with many more receptors. Our sense of taste is actually the one sense that does not diminish with age. So being able to taste salt, sour, sweet, and bitter does not decline with age.
What about Connie's other story about the man trying to smell like a dog?
Well, there was a recent study done actually in California where the college students, in fact, got down on their hands and knees and snuffled across a grassy field to find a piece of chocolate. And their scent tracking, as it were, was monitored, and they behaved in a very similar way to the way a dog would in terms of tracking a scent that they're looking for in the grass. Actually, in their case, the student sense it was sort of a rope that was scented with chocolate. So certainly the parallels between humans and dogs are truly there. And like I said earlier, it's really a question of sensitivity. So if the smell is strong enough, and at least for the particular individual who's smelling it, then they can certainly behave like a dog.
Well, we can be proud of ourselves at least in that I read in your book that new mothers can recognize their two-day-old children by smell alone. That's pretty amazing.
Well, mothers can actually do it in less than an hour. Newborns can recognize their mothers as well. They need about 2 days of experience to be able to do that. But mothers have an incredible ability to recognize their own infant from a number of other newborn infants to know which one is mine and not mine.
I had a son a couple of years ago, and something I hadn't heard about was, you know, that the smell that newborns get on their foreheads, it's so distinct. I can see where mothers might be really especially attuned to that.
Right, and what the reason why one is so good at being able to figure out who's my baby compared to all the other ones in the nursery is that the smell that is the newborn at that time is actually a combination of smell from both the mother and the infant. So part of the mother's scent, which has been in her amniotic fluid the whole time that she's been pregnant, is part of sort of the external body odor of a newborn. And so her scent is part of his scent, or her scent too. And then because also the similarity between the two individuals, because they're genetically related, is there, that the mother is able to detect the sort of, this is more familiar to me, is really what's happening. It's not so much that this is mine and I know it because, but rather, this is the most familiar one to me and therefore it must be mine.
Let's go back to the phones. Here's a call from Andy in Chicago. Hi, Andy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I recall whenever we got hold of men's magazines when we were in high school, there were ads in the back for pheromones. I remember a doctor, she had a unique name, Winifred Cutler,
yep.
Selling pheromones that were guaranteed to attract beautiful women. And I always wondered if that was a load of bunk. Of course, it would be a bonanza for any boy in high school, but I'm curious to hear your comments on that.
Thanks for the question.
Well, let me just ask you this. If it weren't a load of bunk, and I'm being a little bit strong right now, wouldn't there be an enormous industry for pheromones? Where, I mean, this is obviously the billion-dollar quest. And unfortunately, it does not seem in humans that there is any sort of true pheromonal communication from the point of view of instant behavior, any kind of behavioral response that takes place as a function of one chemical being emitted by one person and then the other person responds because of the chemical. Now, there is strong evidence for a different kind of pheromone effect, which is called a primer pheromone effect, which actually produces a physiological change, and that is women who live together start cycling together in terms of their periods after a given length of time, and that seems to be as a function of chemicals which are emitted by one individual affecting the other. But the thing with pheromones, too, is that they do not become apprehended through the sense of smell. That's actually a different chemical system than the sense of smell itself. And one of the problems for the whole quest for human pheromones is that we don't have the hardware that detects pheromones that other animals have. Now, that being said, it's still possible for us to, let's say, perceive chemicals maybe through the skin. Like if I'm sharing clothing with one of my roommates, maybe that's partly how it's happening. Or it could be that the olfactory system is picking certain things up that don't have smells to them. This is actually currently unknown. But the ability to attract scores of beautiful women by wearing a particular fragrance that has, quote-unquote, pheromone in it is not because of the pheromone, but there certainly is evidence that if women like the cologne you're wearing, that they will be attracted to you. So you can skip the pheromone component of it, and if you wear some sort of a fragrance that women find very attractive, or certain women anyway, that once you're interested in, then you can attract them to you in that sense.
Have you discovered whether there is a particular cologne that most women like?
Well, no, I certainly don't know that, but people who are in, for example, I think the people that make Axe, you know, and the whole commercials that they have going with that, they're really not far from the mark, because they've created something which has become popular, and one of the things, because smell works in such a learned way, things that are popular tend to be liked, especially if they have that connection to them, the sexual connection and so forth. So you can hit upon fragrances which, like fashion, get to be very popular for a period of time, but then also, like fashion, they need to be replaced, and then they move along. So our liking of fragrance in that sense is very much like fashion.
Thanks a lot for the call, Andy. And here's Joe calling from Green Bay. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to comment on what you said earlier about fragrances being more familiar, and the ones that we don't smell that often are the ones that bring back perhaps more of an emotion. I wanted to comment on that and say that it is kind of true for me anyway. I had a girlfriend 13 years ago in high school, and we broke up kind of abruptly, but the point is, for the 4 years that we were together in high school, she wore this, I'm sure it was a very low-end vanilla perfume, and I'm not very fond of it. I guess I wasn't then, but it's one of those fragrances you don't smell that much anymore. And I'm happily married now with children of my own to a different woman. But I smell this probably once or twice a year. I mean, it's that rare. And it hits me like a ton of bricks, you know, and it brings me back for some reason. And it's not like I have a fixation or anything, but it's this smell. And it just, and there's nothing I can do. I'm almost paralyzed by it. It's just crazy. But I just wanted to bring that up, that yes, these smells that we don't get that often are the most powerful ones, the ones that bring back emotion that you didn't even know was there anymore.
Joe, does it affect you with baking vanilla, or is it just this perfume?
Just a perfume. It's very odd. Hmm. It's very odd. Just this one, and it's I can't explain it. But
well, thanks for that call, Joe. Rachel Hertz.
Well, that is a perfect example of both the fact that it's the very specific smell, so not just kind of any old smell that's kind of like this is going to work, but the very particular smell itself is what's going to be the trigger, and the fact that memories that are triggered by smells really can completely blindside you. You know, the fact that there you are walking along, and also because smells are invisible, you can't know when one's coming along and deke out of the way before it gets to you. There you are minding your own business, and all of a sudden you smell something, and just like the story said, you're right back there immediately, you know, vividly experiencing the emotion and vividly remembering this person. And so smells really, that's one of their, you know, unique aspects with respect to emotion and memory, is being able to completely sweep us away without any preparation. And unfortunately, where this can become quite serious is people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, and where smell is part of the trauma that initially caused effect to take place. And you can, from a clinical perspective, work with these people to try to help them desensitize to the other stimuli that were involved in the initial trauma so that they are able to go out and function in the world. But because smells are invisible and you never know when you might be, you know, encountering one, it's much harder to work with them, and also much harder from a clinical perspective of knowing how to do sort of the traditional approaches that one normally does with phobias to treat it. So smells can work in, you know, wonderful, mysterious ways, bringing us back to fabulous, mediocre, and also terrible moments in our life.
Once we've had this association, as Joe did with his perfume, is there anything that we can do to free ourselves? Do these scent triggers fade with time, or is it sort of something you're stuck with your whole life?
Well, that's also a great point. And what seems to be the case with smell is actually they stay very indelibly connected to the first association that one had to them. So in Joe's case, he had this association to this vanilla perfume. That was the initial time he had it, and it was a long-term relationship, this girlfriend for 4 years. And then no one else has replaced that. And what would have to be the case is that someone of greater significance than this previous person would have to wear that perfume and then it would sort of eventually erase and then replace them with this new person. Or he could just expose himself to this perfume so much that it became connected with all kinds of different things and then would eventually fade off. But unless there's a even greaterly more emotional experience that's connected with a scent again in the future, or that smell just becomes so ubiquitous that it sort of wipes itself out, it's very hard to undo an association to a smell once it's made.
That's interesting stuff. Rachel Hertz, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been great.
We're talking with Rachel Hertz. She has been recognized as the world's leading expert on the psychology of smell. She studies that sense at Brown University and is the author of the book, The Scent of Desire. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for on-air production and for producing that hour. And if you'd like a copy of that program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.